Hello, everybody. My name is Toni Reale, and I am the Coastal Program Coordinator for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. As part of my position, I manage a diverse network of environmental advocates, local elected officials, academics, renewable energy business owners, farmers, and entrepreneurs, all the way from Maryland to Louisiana. As you can see on your screen, this is the Southeast Coastal Climate Network. This is the network that I manage, and we are dedicated to fostering regional leadership in mitigating and adapting to the challenge of global warming. You can see the link on here to join. We will soon be on Facebook, but if you'd like to join the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, we have a group site there, and many of you that I see logged in are already part of this network. If you are in Florida, we actually have a sister group called the Florida Climate Alliance. And there's no participation obligation in either of these networks. It's a way that we send out news related to climate and energy issues that we feel that our members would be interested in, as well as webinar opportunities and other opportunities as well. So the host organization for the Southeast Coastal Climate Network and the Florida Climate Alliance is my organization, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And this webinar is actually the seventh in a series that both ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability, and the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy have put together over the last year or so. And all of our webinars have been focused on issues surrounding coastal climate adaptation in the Southeast. And here's some information about ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability. They have actually just presented last month on some tools that they have for local governments to start working on coastal climate adaptation plans. So I highly encourage folks to also check out our partners, ICLEI. They have a whole host of great information. So with us today, I am really pleased to have with us Skip Stiles, who is the Executive Director of Wetlands Watch. It's a nonprofit working in Virginia to conserve wetlands. Wetlands Watch has spent the majority of the last 4 years working on local government adaptation to sea level rise, as they believe this is the best way to ensure the future of Virginia's tidal wetlands, which are at risk from sea level rise. Before working for Wetlands Watch, Skip worked as a private consultant on science and environmental policy issues for a range of government and foundation clients, a job that built upon his 22 years previous work as a senior staffer in the U.S. House of Representatives. Skip is married to an oceanographer who informs his work and has two children that continuously inspire him and add urgency to his work. So Skip, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very pleased to have you. And if you can go ahead and unmute yourself. Just press star 6.
There you go. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
All right. Great.
I'm going to go ahead and change it over to you now.
All right.
So folks should see Skip's presentation here in just a second.
All right. Is it up?
It is. Yes.
Okay.
Not on the title slide, though.
Oh, hold on. I'm sorry. Hold on. There we go. Now I'm good. Sorry about
there
that.
There you go.
All right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today. What I wanted to do was to run through the work that we've been doing in Virginia for most of the last 4 years on adaptation, talk to you about some of the shifts and back and forth and barriers we've hit, and then talk a bit about some of the work that we're doing now with a slightly different orientation and a broader set of tools. So let's get started. Essentially, I was on the Virginia Climate Change Commission, and these were the best data points we had for endpoints for climate change in the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia region over the next 100 years. 2.3 to 5.2 feet of sea level rise, a dangerous increase in temperature of 3 degrees centigrade, and an increase in rainfall intensity. These are all problematic, but I wanted to talk today specifically about sea level rise, since, as I'll show you, that is the biggest issue here. This slide shows you the ups and downs of sea level over the last 400,000 years. It's a natural cycle. Essentially, when the temperatures warm up, sea level rises. And when it gets cold, sea level falls because the water leaves the ocean in the form of ice and snow, and it sits on the land. So that's the ups and downs. And let's look at the last big cycle that we're still in on sea level rise and fall. And you can see about 20,000 years ago at the last glacial maximum, when glaciers were 2 miles thick over New York, sea level was about 120 meters lower. And the coastline was there. It's the continental shelf. So that's where the coastline was during the big chill when we had the glacial maximum. Going back, you have to go back about 120,000 years to find the last big melt, and that's was about 5 meters above the present sea level. So where does 5 meters sit on the land? If you go to the University of Arizona, Weiss and Overpeck have a mapping system, and you can plug in 5 meters. And basically, the red parts of this map, which are now land, obviously, would be underwater with 5 meters. So you can see the impact on the Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina region. And if you snap down to where we are in Hampton Roads in southeastern Virginia, this is what it looks like. And essentially, the various colors on the map are storm surge zones. We don't have very good maps in Virginia, so we use storm surge zones as a proxy. The red zone is category one. That's about 4.5-5 feet on average. Those are the zones that are most at risk from the sea level rise we're going to be seeing. But what you see in this picture is to the east of that black line, to the right of that black line, lots of low-lying areas. And that black line is a bump up in the land of about 5 meters, 15 feet. And that's where the shoreline was, best guess where the shoreline was during the last big glacial melt, the big melt shoreline. For us, east of that shoreline is the issue because there's 1.2 million people east of that that shoreline, the old shoreline. And more importantly, if you look at the economic activity, the OECD in 2007 ranked our region as 10th in the world in terms of assets at risk from sea level rise. So we've got a lot of people and a lot of economic activity that's at risk. Now, sea level rise by itself is not what causes the inundation. You also have to add in what the land is doing. And these are actual tide measurements from various places around the country. And you can see in Galveston, where the land is sinking because of groundwater withdrawal and petroleum withdrawals, the land is actually sinking. So you've got a base sea level rise, but the land is sinking. So if you're standing on the ground in Galveston, it looks like the sea level rise is real high. If you're in Alaska, where they're making mountains and the ground is actually going up, relative to where you're standing on the ground in Sitka, Alaska, sea level is actually falling because the ground is going up faster than the sea level is rising. So, you know, different parts of the country have different impacts depending on what the ground is doing. And this chart from the Climate Change Science Program study of 2009 shows it. These are tide gauge measurements in millimeters per year. Where you see a 3, 3 millimeters is 30 centimeters a century. That's a foot. So where you see a 3 is a foot of sea level rise. And you can see up in Washington State, they're actually the sea level is actually falling. In the purple circle, that's New Orleans at about 3-plus feet per 100 years. But when you go over to the East Coast and you look up and down, you see the red circle, which is Norfolk, and that's a foot and a half of sea level rise. That's the rate over 100 years. So we have the highest rate of sea level rise along the East Coast because our land is sinking more rapidly than most parts of the East Coast. So as Wetlands Watch, we looked at this and we said, well, what's this going to do to tidal wetlands? And we basically came to the conclusion that Virginia would lose about 50 to 80% of its tidal wetlands. This is what put us in action to begin adaptation work. This rough estimate of ours was later confirmed by the Climate Change Science Program. Essentially on that map, everything that's not green, those are all wetlands. All of those wetlands will go underwater with the rates of sea level rise that we're looking at. So there you can see the potential impact of sea level rise on the tidal ecosystem. So so we went out and we said, well, what happens to the tidal ecosystem? Well, as sea level goes up, the marshes will either move vertically or they'll move uphill as the tidal zone moves uphill. Wetlands today are protected by regulations, and here in the state of Virginia, we actually have a buffer on the shoreline that, properly enforced, also takes care of the coastal ecosystem. But the rates of sea level rise we're talking about is going to move the shoreline beyond today's environmental regulatory jurisdictions and up onto private land. And so this was the problem we were looking at, was we can probably use existing regulations to deal with wetlands for a while, but if we don't do something about what's going on behind the wetlands and the buffer, we're going to have a problem with sea level rise at the rates we're looking at. When you get onto private land, it's developable. So if you want to stop the development, is it a takings? Do you have to pay the folks who own that land? The other side of the argument is, well, there's a public benefit here, a public need, so does the common trust doctrine come in? And I won't even go into the details on this, but I would, if you want more details, there's an excellent publication down there in that, off to the left, The Coastal No Adverse Impact. If you Google on that, the floodplain managers have put out an excellent discussion of the legal ramifications of what's going to be happening. So we said, all right, 85% of Virginia's shoreline is privately owned, and keeping the tidal shoreline open and resilient is what we're up to. That means limiting development and limiting shoreline hardening. Well, you go to local governments for that, because all private land use decisions, occupancy permits, business permits, and many environmental decisions are made by local governments. In Virginia and in a lot of states, local governments are required to review their long-range land use plans. In Virginia, it's every 5 years. So we wanted to know, can we, and that means some funding from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and our base funding from Campbell Foundation, can we get local governments to include climate change and shoreline ecosystem adaptation in their long-range plans? That's what we started out to do in 2007-2008. Our goal was to protect that little postage stamp size of the landscape, which was wetlands and buffers. And we asked ourselves, what tools do we have? Well, as I said, we've got state and federal wetlands laws. Well, who are our partners in this work? It's the Corps of Engineers and EPA. And the State Department of Environmental Quality. All of them regulate wetlands. The buffers behind the wetlands, Chesapeake Bay Act is the controlling authority. Who's involved there? Well, the Department of Conservation and Recreation and local governments. Easements, transfer, purchase, and development rights, all tools that we can use. Again, these are the partners involved in that, DCR and the local government. And, of course, land use regulations. So we began to work using those partners and those tools to protect the shoreline ecosystem from climate change impacts. And what we found was, well, we don't know what the feds are up to. We are systematically challenging tidal wetlands permits in southeastern Virginia based on sea level rise, alleging that you have to take sea level rise into account because of the cumulative impacts and a whole lot of other things. We haven't gotten any decisions back yet from the federal government as to whether our position has any validity. We know that the State Department of Environmental Quality doesn't agree with us. They say they don't have the authority to look at sea level rise. And when we've looked at other statutes, we find that the State Department of Conservation and Recreation is not willing to step up. And local governments are doing a lot of work planning, but we've looked and looked and looked, and we cannot find, as of yet, any development or redevelopment decision that's been turned down based on the risk that's posed from sea level rise. So we didn't get very far with this approach. And here were the challenges facing us. In Virginia, the property owner owns the low tide line, so they own a lot of the marsh. Local government powers are restricted by state constitution. It's a strong property rights state. And we're last in the country in per capita spending on natural resources. So we can't buy our way out of we can't buy the open shoreline that we need. On the wetland side, Virginia's never met its no net loss wetlands regulatory goal for tidal wetlands. We have an inventory that's 30 years old, and we have no database to track the wetlands restoration efforts. So you can see a lot of things were stacked against us. Now, interestingly, a number of counties have begun, Virginia Beach, including sea level rise and climate change in their long-range plans, and recognize that these localities are doing it without state leadership, and they're really pioneers. So in Virginia, which everybody thinks is doing nothing on sea level rise, more and more often local governments are taking the lead in this, and they're beginning to include sea level rise and climate change in their long-range plans. The problems we face, though, are the cost of solving climate change is borne by individuals, by taxpayers today, and the benefits are somewhere out in the future. So this is the policy, political, the marketing challenge that we all face. And if you translate it into the work we were doing, basically we're asking individual landowners to forego financial gain, and we're asking localities to forego property tax on shoreline property today, because in 50 years we'll be able to avoid costs from sea level rise. Well, this is a very hard bargain to make. It, you know, it looks like some of the stuff you get in your inbox from Nigerian bankers. You know, I mean, this is a very, very hard conversation to have. The other thing is, people, by and large, haven't yet made that connection. So, you know, this is a quote from the Baltimore Sun. We get a lot of indifference. It's like, give me a break. You know, I'll be gone by the time all of this is done. And the pushback that we get ranges from indifference to actual resistance. And this is a builder down our way who said basically, look, you can't tell me that just because sea level's coming up, I can't build, it's not realistic. And this fella is the head of the Tidewater Builders Green Building Council. So this is the kind of pushback that we're getting with this approach. So we said, wait a minute, all right, if our goal is to protect that little postage stamp size of the shoreline, we need more tools, more partners, more compelling arguments, and frankly, less mention of climate change. Because when you go into a rural county and talk climate change, that takes the whole conversation in a different direction. So we then re-engineered our approach and said, well, what do we do? Well, we took a broader look of the shoreline and found that there was all sorts of stuff going on around the wetlands that if we could deal with it, would mean that people would not be doing as much work in that blue zone on this picture in front of you, which is the same area that we want to keep open for the wetlands. So we then went back and we looked at our base data and started reframing our work. So we went back to this map and we said, what else can we say about this? Well, we discovered that outside of New Orleans, Hampton Roads is the largest population area at highest risk from sea level rise in the U.S. Boom, suddenly we were impacting everybody, not just people who care about wetlands. We then looked and we said, all right, what's with our message? We got to make it personal. So we said, instead of talking years and decades, we talked in terms of children and grandchildren's lifetime. We decided, you know, we've got to make it local. We've got to make it real. So we began to talk in terms of what sea level rise is already doing in somebody's community. We talked to some of the psychology department people at ODU who helped us frame some of this. So instead of asking people, is sea level rise affecting your life, you assume that it is, and you ask them, how many times have you had to change your commute in the last X period of time? Why is your house insurance getting more expensive? And we got a lot better response with these approaches. We also wanted to try to move those two purple blobs on that graph closer together by talking about life cycle costing, or what the Navy is calling total ownership cost. So we begin to ask people, you know, over your business planning horizon, the time you own your house, whatever, what is sea level rise going to do? And, you know, where are the flood zone maps going to move? We also, in our area, you know, the blessing and curse of having high sea level rates is that you don't have to talk about climate change. And so, you know, we didn't have to get into the arguments about anthropogenic climate change or not, at least right now, in order to move adaptation, because as this cartoon shows, people are, you know, shoulder deep in water, and there's no room for argument if we're going to move ahead. So what we did was we said, well, what kind of things can we present people? And so we went and we took the tide gauges. This one is the one in Norfolk. And we normalized all of the floods that we had seen. We took the high storm events over the last 100 years or so, 70-some years, and we normalized in the current sea level. And as you can see on this map, it's interesting, in our region, hurricanes are a problem, but a bigger problem are nor'easters. Our tributaries face north and east, and we get killed by nor'easters. So a lot of our storms are nor'easters, and they last for days and days. So we took the flood data, and we normalized it. We wanted to find out how much of today's, say, streets in Norfolk were made wet by these storms. and we mean high water without a lot of detail, that's where the spring tide comes twice a month. So nobody lives below that line. So we wanted to figure out, okay, behind the limit of development, how much of that land got wet in 1933 with our record hurricane? How much is getting wet today? So we took the chart. We said, okay, let's take these two nor'easters. Well, 100 years ago, they wouldn't even be on this chart because we've had a foot and a half of sea level since those storms came. I mean, since if you go back 100 years. But the problem is 100 years from now, those storms will exceed the maximum storm we've had. And this has really started catching the attention of emergency managers and floodplain managers because this is very serious. These two problematic nor'easters suddenly become the storms of record. So we then went out and said, okay, how can we show this visually? And when we go into a community, we try to take pictures locally. This is easy because this is around the corner for me. This is Norfolk on a dry day. This is Norfolk during that nor'easter. And what you see in this picture that's interesting is those two structures, that apartment building and that church in the background, have been around during the whole period of that tide gauge. And some of these structures, the church, for example, has had flooding. They've had to replace their heating system three times in the last 12 years. When our grandparents and great-grandparents put those buildings in place, they weren't meant to get wet. So something's happening. And you can go out and you can show people, okay, if this nor'easter hit 100 years ago, it would come here. But here's the problem. In 100 years, it'll hit here, and that building will essentially be made useless. That, by the way, is also the level that that storm of record, the 33 storm, hit. So we try to show people visually what's going on in their community. One of the ways we discuss life cycle costing, we look at some decisions that have been made. In this case, this house was raised for about $130,000 after Hurricane Isabel through the FEMA post-hazard mitigation program. That is the same house there, the gray one in the middle. This is not during a storm. The folks in this neighborhood move their cars twice a month on a new moon and a full moon because of the tides. And this is a day, wrong time of the month, a little blow from the north, and that's what you get. This is the neighborhood that was featured in that New York Times article back in December because the city of Norfolk is spending $1.23 million to raise that street. Well, now you have to ask, if I took that $130,000 for that house and the money I'm spending on the street, would it have made more sense to buy those houses out, make the landowners whole, and just walk away from what's becoming an increasingly expensive deal? With a stable shoreline, waterfront property is the best part of your tax base. With a shoreline that's moving, the equation flips, and it suddenly costs a locality more tax dollars to maintain that tax base than it's paying back in. And this is one of the realities of taking a look at a life cycle cost decision, like should I raise that house or not? And it's becoming increasingly apparent to localities that these bargains are not what they were in the past. This is a map of Norfolk with its 100-year floodplain and some of the assets that are in that floodplain, recognizing that as time goes on and sea level rises, the 100-year floodplain becomes a 50-year floodplain, a 25-year floodplain, and eventually becomes an area that's inundated fairly regularly. These are the kinds of assets that we have in place that we've got to deal with. This is a figure that was put together by Northrop Grumman. They run a shipyard here. It's the largest manufacturing employer in Virginia. The only nuclear-capable shipyard in the U.S. They make all of the aircraft carriers here. And they wanted to find out, well, what's sea level rise going to do to the flooding at my facility? Because obviously it's along the shoreline if it's a shipbuilding facility. And a record flood of 8 feet knocks them out of business until they can dry the place out. Historically, that happened every 80 years. With current rates of sea level rise, it's every 27 years. With 2 feet, it's every 7.3 years. And with 3 feet, which is what people now think is sort of the minimum we're going to get, it's every 1.7 years. So shoreline businesses in this region are starting to look at this and go, wait a minute, you know, what is sea level rise going to be doing to my business picture? It's not just urban areas. This is Matthews County along the western side of the Chesapeake Bay. And you can see in this picture, you know, former forests are now underwater. Those gray trees up in the upper left are ghost forests that you see in many areas in tidal parts of Virginia. And the big question is, with the shoreline moving 4 feet per year to the left, which is what the Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences estimates, what do you do with that house? What's the responsibility of taxpayers, landowners, to the folks in that house? So, you know, again, local governments are being faced with these questions today. The people who are asking the most questions, of course, are the insurance industries. And here in eastern Virginia, we've seen a withdrawal of significant portions of the private insurance market. And these are on new policies, first homes, and businesses. The insurance industry is beginning to put significant pressure to do something about this problem. So, with these broader concerns, can you bring more people to the table and provide more adaptation tools? What we found is, yes, you can. Because if you look at the landscape of the shoreline and you begin to look at who else is active along that shoreline, you've got water-dependent businesses. Well, in addition to the partners we've already got, you then start bringing other people in, Economic Development Administration from the Department of Commerce, insurance companies, banks, people who finance all of these operations. They've all now got a stake long-term in what goes on along the shoreline. If you look at some of the other businesses that are not water-dependent, you bring even more people in. Department of Agriculture, for example, has a range of programs that deal with the farms along the shoreline. And then if you look at the non-water-dependent businesses, you bring in even more people. Housing and Urban Development, Department of Transportation, what's with that road right there, FEMA. So the new partners that we've got and the new tools we've got are beginning to expand. And we put together a toolkit. And if you just look at the federal tools that we've got, you know, FEMA is a major player, requires plans at the state and local level for hazard mitigation. The flood insurance program gives reduced rates for regularly developed and regularly updated floodplain management plans. And again, here in Virginia, we have some pioneers. Gloucester County's floodplain management plan has a piece in there on sea level rise and the risks. City of Pocosin the same way. City of Portsmouth. So increasingly, local governments, in response to these federal planning mandates, are beginning to include sea level rise into their planning documents. And because these are public processes, it's a place where the public and the citizens who are concerned can also get involved. Another tool. The Department of Commerce says before you spend a dime of Economic Development Administration money, you have to have a regional sustainable economic development plan. In our region, it's a document called Hampton Roads Vision. It has climate change listed as a potential threat to our economy, sea level rise specifically. And this was a publicly developed document. So here again, this is another place where you can begin to move these issues along and also get policymakers and business leaders more familiar with the long-range consequences. Transportation planning is required, again, at each state and region. So every region has a metropolitan planning organization that puts together the long-range plan for their region. And here in Virginia, our state plan has a piece on climate change. So here's another place where forward-looking planning programs can become tools for beginning to move climate change adaptation. Now, what's interesting is as we get into this, we find even more problems. For example, when we look at transportation planning, you might say, okay, I want to raise this road up so I don't get stuck like the house in that picture having to raise it later. I'm going to raise my road up. I'm going to go beyond the FEMA minimum elevation. And, you know, I'm going to get ahead of this problem. Well, you find out that the Federal Highway Administration doesn't pay for any road construction above the federal FEMA minimum. So, you know, as we go along, we're finding openings, but then it's also leading to even more conflicts as these various federal and state policies interact. So we're continuing to drill down on that. This is a list of some other federal programs that we found. You got to have a wildlife action plan to get Fish and Wildlife Service money in Virginia, and other states are doing climate change. National Forest Management Act says you got to do a long-range plan on your forests, and our forests are being looked at. There's a HUD planning requirement, a stormwater planning requirement by the EPA. there's just a whole host of these programs into which climate change should and, in some cases, is being inserted. And again, these are just looking at some of the federal programs. There's a whole suite of state programs we've identified as well. The issue is, for us, is the planning is sort of becoming more routine. The next step up is to begin to identify where infrastructure, roads, highways, fire stations, police precinct houses, and the rest need to go in, and making sure that those investment and infrastructure decisions are made with sea level rise in mind. Don't put a firehouse, which is also a haven during a flooding event, in a low-lying area. Those kinds of things need to start working their way in. But eventually we're going to get up to regulation, and this is where we really are going to have a difficult time, because as you move up, you encounter increasing political difficulty. So we're working on the planning with an eye towards the fact that eventually we're going to get to some of these more difficult stages. Another way of looking at this, this was an interesting article that just came out by Mosier and Ekstrom, is, you know, in the short term you do coping measures, which are fairly easy to do. In the longer term, it's more substantial adjustments. And then finally, where we're headed is towards system transformation. And this chart sort of mirrors what was in that last one. It's a long-term, sustained effort, and it's going to take a lot of time. The goal, long quote here, but the goal here is in that last sentence. Appeal to people's reason may help, but rational belief won't carry the day. And this is what we're finding, is that if you argue facts with people, it's a factual argument. If you want to move people, you talk about, have you had to change your path to work? Have you seen higher insurance? You know, has your lifestyle been affected by this? And we're going to have to do, if we're going to get to the difficult job of a systematic transformation, we're going to have to do more of this work, and we're going to have to do more work to engage both the left and the right side of the brain. And this is something we're just beginning to look at now, things like, with the help of some of the folks at Old Dominion University, you know, what's the role of visual arts in making the climate change debate real? I like this. This was an installation by Nelly Azevedo. He put a whole lot of melting men out, and that was an installation. Another piece of it is this. This was from the Museum of Modern Art work on sort of visualizing New York City with sea level rise. And this is another key piece of this, is we've got to show people a path forward. We present a problem, they understand it, and they go, well, what do I do? So we need to begin to think about what is the reality of adaptation going to look like in the future, and do it visually so that people can get their heads around it. With that, I think I'll stop there. These are some folks who help us, and if anyone wants to get in touch with me, that's where I am. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Skip, thank you so much. That was one of the most compelling webinars I've had the pleasure of hosting in a long time. So thank you so much. Those pictures were really amazing of Norfolk, and thank you for sharing that. If anybody has any questions, please go ahead and chat them in. I just have a couple here. So for those of you who have questions, go ahead and type them in the box and hit send, and they will come my way. The first question is, have you spoken to local communities about retreats? And if so, how is that sort of received?
I have spoken to some county staff about it, some of whom are probably on this call. That is the toughest issue to deal with. Now, in Norfolk, we're just completing an inundation study that the city asked for. And when it was initially unpacked back in August for the city council, our mayor said that there may be zones in our city which we're going to have to declare retreat zones, in which we cannot continue to occupy. That was the first time I have ever heard a seated politician say that about his or her city. I haven't even heard that out of New Orleans. I mean, Nagin never said it out of New Orleans. This is the sort of third rail, and it is a very, very difficult issue, because if you say, you know, there may be places we can't stay, the next question is, well, where are they, and is one of them where I live, and if so, I'm going to sell my house could you hold off on your announcement? This is the very difficult part, but it is the reality that we're going to have to get to. I think it's going to require much better mapping and inundation prediction before people can with certainty say these areas are a problem. But people living in these neighborhoods know where they are, but they just that is a very, very difficult conversation. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. That was helpful. Next question is, how do you feel about moving the discussion past adaptation issues and into mitigation? And do you find a link between adaptation and mitigation?
I think that that's where we definitely have to go. We have got to deal with mitigation. The problem is, as I said, you know, once you get into a climate change discussion, even, you know, just getting away from sea level rise to climate change moves the conversation in a whole different direction. And I've been in any number of Rotary talks where half of the time was spent with my justifying why I thought there was an anthropogenic problem with climate change and climate gate and everything else. And it just gets to be a very difficult conversation. That's why we've stayed with sea level rise. But we cannot fix this problem simply with adaptation. What we're trying to do is to use sea level rise to get people to, no pun intended, stick their toe in the water of climate change, engage them in a broader discussion about climate change, and then begin a conversation about mitigation. The problems in Virginia, as with much of the Southeast, is that these are very carbon-intensive economies in our states. You know, there are those in our legislature who refer to Virginia as the Saudi Arabia of coal. And so, you know, you can't get elected statewide in Virginia without paying homage to the western part of the state and the coal regions. So, you know, it's a very difficult conversation to say, all right, we need to go to a post-carbon economy. What we're hoping is that as we make clear what the costs of business as usual are on one of the major economic engines of our state here in Hampton Roads, that we then can level the political playing field in Richmond, in our capital, and begin to have rational conversations about the need to move to a different reality in our energy use. So we're sort of, you know, coming at this from a different angle. We definitely agree that we need to have the mitigation conversation. We're just trying to level the playing field so that when we have it, you know, we don't get rolled the way we have typically gotten rolled in Virginia in the past.
Okay, thank you. Skip, it looks like you have something on your screen that you might want to
get rid of it. Yeah, somebody's trying to send me some software.
Okay. Well, I've had a lot of comments typed in saying that people think this presentation was fantastic, and one person asks that or suggests that local businesses and banks would be a great audience for this webinar and wants to know if you've done anything in that sort of direction.
We've been trying to do more work with the business sector because, again, in our work we found that that's where the real deep work needs to be done. And so I've been trying to initially getting to service clubs, knowing that many business leaders are in service clubs, and then working to chambers of commerce and other gatherings to try to talk to people about the sort of economic realities of this issue. The key piece of this is being able to point people to what the insurance industries are doing, because once, if I am in a conversation with a business audience and start mentioning insurance, the conversation just goes. I don't have to direct it. We are engaging in a number of private conversations with businesses along the shoreline. Again, most folks are very reluctant to discuss this because they're worried about what happens to their shoreline property valuation. But increasingly, the reality of lost business days from flooding, the reality of increased insurance premiums, are giving us a much more receptive audience, you know, outside of the real estate sector. The real estate sector is a nut we haven't cracked yet. But we recognize that we need to go in the direction of having these conversations with the business sector. We're in conversations with some of the folks in the, again, in the psychology department at Old Dominion University about putting together some focus groups and some other tools to start developing marketing, social marketing strategies specifically to the business sector.
Great, thank you. The next question is, this participant would like to hear more about the partnership between Wetlands Watch and ODU, and in particular, how non-government coalitions add to what governments can and should do. Follow-up to that is, will these coalitions be required for the long term rather than just to move past the current political impasses on policy?
Yeah, let me talk about the roles of NGOs, because we've taken an approach because there's a leadership vacuum in our state on this issue, and because we've got some pioneering local governments, we've started to try to take on the role of sort of helping and nurturing and using fact-based advocacy to move some of these folks along, networking, hey, you know, County X did this, have you seen that? And I think that because we're an NGO, we have much more freedom to move about. We're not bureaucratically bound. We don't have an agency head that's saying, no, don't do that. And because we use a fact-based advocacy, I mean, as you can see from this presentation, everything we do is grounded in some factual peer-reviewed information. You know, we're able, I think, to help move the process along. We can also speak truth to power, which is something agency folks frequently cannot do. So where we find a cooperative and interested state agency or a local government staff, but they're bound by the political restrictions, oh, the county board would never let me do this, we can actually move outside and begin to talk to people on the county board or the city council about the need for this in ways that local government staff cannot. And so I think there is a very strong role for NGOs to move this issue along. Our partnership with Old Dominion University is an interesting one, because ODU, basically being on the water, got tired of getting wet, and they noticed there was a problem. And they actually have organized a climate initiative, and we were, Wetlands Watch was in the middle of helping put that together, and we found that there are all sorts of resources on campus that that can help us in our work, as I've mentioned on this webinar. We've also formed an alliance with the University of Virginia's Institute for Environmental Negotiations, and in March we'll be holding some mediated listening sessions on sea level rise in the city of Virginia Beach. And so again, you know, we've been able to bring academic expertise to some of our work, and it really is moving it along. I think these are the kind of sort of non-traditional partnerships that non-government organizations need to begin to look for. And also, I think for local and state agency staff, I think, you know, there's a real benefit in finding the right fit with an NGO out there who can help move your agenda along, and again, be able to speak truth to power in ways that that state and local agency staff sometimes cannot.
Thanks, Skip. Next question here is, as sea level rises, how does it impact rivers and tributaries outside of the coastal zone?
Well, it'll affect them up to the fall line. In our state, that's roughly Route 95, it'll affect these systems significantly. I mean, the salinity gradients will start moving upriver, so you're going to change the ecosystems of some of these rivers where you now have, you know, tidal freshwater marshes. You're going to get brackish marshes, and as the sea level rises, you're going to get increased erosion all the way along the tidal range of these rivers, again, up to the fall line. It's going to have some significant impact on the fisheries and the ecosystems, but you are going to see more erosion, more salinity, probably more saltwater intrusion into shallower groundwater systems, which is a problem. Beyond the fall line, the sea level is not going to have any impact because it can't climb up over the falls. So those systems are, you know, we don't know what's going to be going on with those. The climate change impacts on those are probably going to be more increased rainfall intensity events and temperature increases and the like.
Great. Thanks, Skip. Next question is from Jessica Whitehead in Charleston. Local governments I work with accept that sea level is rising, but asking them to plan for an accelerated sea level rise rate requires that they accept climate change is occurring. Even if you avoid the climate science, the governments bring it back to argue against taking any action. Do you have any advice for bridging this barrier, especially in places where the sea level rise rate is lower than in Virginia?
You know, the one thing that we found we got a lot of early resonance with was storm surges on top of the sea level rise. And again, you know, if you use local tide gauges, you can start seeing the increase. If you look at the required reporting on repetitive losses from storm surges and flooding, you traditionally, I mean, all along the shoreline, you see an increase. If you start stacking those indicators up, you know, the storm surges, the increasing repetitive losses, if you talk to claims adjusters, I have a good relationship with the claims adjusters in this community, and they keep me informed on, you know, increases in claims and who the claims are coming from. That's one of the ways I was able to document a withdrawal of private insurance was these adjusters were seeing more work from Lloyd's of London and less work from traditional insurance companies. And you begin to stack that evidence up, and it shows everywhere. Then you can start making an argument that, well, you know, there's something going on here. We also have used, at times, non-sea level rise data to make cases, the appearance of fire ants, for example. Fire ants in this region now are starting to close parks. They weren't up here before because the colder weather kept them out. If you look at the 2009 Audubon bird count, it documented a shift in the range of birds. If you talk to duck hunters, they'll tell you the ducks aren't around. They short-stop. They don't come into our region anymore. If you talk to garden clubs, they're able to document earlier emergence. Many of these folks have records that go back 20, 30, 40, 50 years. If you go to the American Arbor Association and you look at the shift, I can't remember the website, but they have a map that documents the recent shift that they had to make in the growing zones. They moved about 200 miles north because of climate change. You stack all this stuff up and you begin to present it in a comprehensive whole, and it's very, very hard to get around the fact that something is going on and it's all headed in the same direction. The other piece that we make a point on from time to time is public policy needs to take all this stuff into account. You can't sort of trust your future to luck any more than an individual can, say, buy a lottery ticket instead of putting their money in a 401k and calling it a retirement plan. You know, public entities, governments need to plan for the sort of worst case, if you will. And if it's not as bad as you thought, well, then you've got better storm surge protection. You know, you've benefited. Insurance companies will probably look more favorably on your locality. So I think these are some of the arguments that if you can put them together in a package, it begins to overcome some of that resistance.
Thanks, Skip. Next question from Kat. Why do you think localities and others can't get their minds wrapped around planning for 50 years out for sea level rise or other climate change impacts, yet they can do these sorts of things for planning for water supplies and in transportation planning issues?
Well, I think the real issue here, on one of those earlier graphs I showed you, you know, it showed you coming up from the glacial max and the curve goes up and it sort of sits there. For the better part of 5,000 years, we've had abnormally stable sea level rise and climate. It's moved a bit, but, you know, since people were building pyramids, we haven't had to even think about this. And it's only been, you know, sea level started moving again about 100 years ago, and it's only been a few years ago that we actually said, oh, wait, you know, there's something going on here. So most, and I showed you some of those statutes, none of those, some of those tools that we've developed, none of those require climate change reporting. It's just areas that are experiencing it have put it in. So people are not required to think about sea level rise in their planning. State statute, federal statutes don't mention sea level rise in any of those tools that I mentioned. And so, you know, you'll plan for a road because someone says, I need a 30-year plan for you before you get any money from the feds for a road. But the feds don't say, oh, and by the way, you got to tell me what's going to happen to that road in 30 years due to sea level rise or climate change. So, you know, in fairness to the local governments, who are by and large the integrators of most of this policy, nobody's telling them they need to do it. They aren't giving them the money to do it. In the case of Virginia, I mean, we don't even have decent elevation maps in Virginia. We're still using, you know, Category 1 storm surge zones as a proxy. So the base elevations and inundation zones and the rest are not available to these planners. I think they will be. I think that as time goes on and more of these pioneer local governments start going, hey, you know, I did the best job I can, but I still have people at risk. You got to help me here. I think as that happens, then there's going to be pressure on state and federal agencies to begin to, A, provide more information, and then, B, require it in these long-range plans.
Thanks, Skip. I have two more questions before we wrap up here.
All right.
This next question comes from Dana. And she writes, I heard that some states and local governments were considering policies that require real estate disclosure statements that disclose risks from sea level rise. Can you offer any details on whether this issue is being considered in Virginia?
You know, that's a critical piece. If you're a diligent and careful home buyer, you can go to floodplain maps that some of the better localities have from their floodplain management plans. You can look parcel by parcel and see where your house is relative to a 1,500-year floodplain. And if you're aware, you could sort of figure, well, I really don't want to move there. I mean, I can't tell you how many calls I get from homeowners saying, should I buy here? And I, you know, I'm real reluctant to give that advice. But there does need to be something. I mean, again, HUD is a critical actor in this because, I don't know, if you've ever bought a house or had a property transaction, there are 5,000 HUD forms that you've got to fill out, none of which is a disclosure form about the past 20 years of losses on that house due to inundation, nor projections of, you know, where this is going to go. HUD is a critical piece of this. If they began through regulatory guidance to sort of require some of this disclosure, I think it would help a lot. There's a woman here in Norfolk who bought a house that floods all the time, and she said when she bought her house, they said it could flood. They didn't say it does flood, nor that it floods twice a month. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that definitely need to be in there. But I think it's mostly a HUD, federal government real estate transaction function that needs to be fixed.
Great. Thanks. And one last question here mm-hmm. comes from Rachel. She said, you mentioned trying to get state government participation and that it's been difficult due to state constitutional limitations. Do you feel that DEQ, DCR might be willing to reconsider implementing regulations due to the new federal TMDL requirements that have been implemented and the Bay goals they need to meet by 2025? I would ask before you answer that if you could give a little bit of background because I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, let me just back up. Local governments in the U.S. sort of operate under two systems. One is home rule, which basically says you can do what you have to at the local government level until we at the state level prohibit it. The flip of that is what they call Dillon rule, named after an Iowa Supreme Court judge, that says basically you can only do what we let you do. So we're in that state. Local governments can only do what a provision in the state law has said they can do. And it really messes with things like smart growth and, in this case, sea level rise adaptation. The second issue of whether the state agencies can act, we're in Virginia, we're now under federal Clean Water Act mandate to clean up the Chesapeake Bay because for 35 years in voluntary efforts we haven't managed to do, haven't managed to meet the Clean Water Act standards. So the state agencies are now bound by the federal government to begin to work to clean up the bay. The problem is that in that bay program, there is no climate change element. And so I don't look for the state agencies to be able to do much because the feds have sort of punted on climate change as a part of the restoration of the Chesapeake Bay, which when you think of it is sort of crazy because that the Chesapeake Bay has warmed considerably over the last 20 or 30 years. And so all of the underwater grasses are beginning to retreat. The fisheries are getting messed up because of climate change. And yet we're proceeding ahead as if there has been no change. And we're going to restore the Chesapeake Bay to a state that it was in, say, in the 1960s, which is impossible because the 1960s, you know, the past is no longer prologue when climate change enters the picture. So it's going to be very difficult to get the state agencies, I think, to move on this because the feds have not said, oh, and by the way, you've got to factor climate change into your state cleanup plans.
Thank you, Skip. I just want to go ahead and show folks one more time where you can find the podcast and the presentation. And let's see here. So if you log on to cleanenergy.org under multimedia, there is a tab for webinar archives, and this is where you can find the podcast and presentation. And you can see here we have about 2 years' worth of webinars all about climate and energy issues. And so, Skip, thank you so much for joining us today. That was a fabulous webinar, and I've already gotten a lot of comments back saying this was excellent. So thank you so much for everything that you're doing in Virginia.
Well, great. And if people want to get in touch, just email or call me. I'd be happy to continue the conversation.
Great. Thank you so much, and everyone have a great day, and I'll be posting this webinar by Monday. Have a good weekend.